Chapter 13. The angel Islington was dreaming a dark and rushing dream. Huge waves were rising and crashing over the city. The night sky was rent with forks of white lightning from horizon to horizon. The rain fell in sheets. The city trembled. Fires started near the great amphitheater and spread quickly through the city, defying the storm. Islington was looking down on everything from far above, hovering in the air as one hovers in dreams, as it had hovered in those long-ago times. There were buildings in that city that were many hundreds of feet high, but they were dwarfed by the grey-green Atlantic waves. And then it heard the people scream. There were 4 million people in Atlantis, and in its dream Islington heard each and every one of their voices clearly and distinctly, as one by one they screamed and choked and burned and drowned and died. The waves swallowed the city, and, at length, the storm subsided. When dawn broke, there was nothing to indicate there had ever been a city there at all, let alone an island twice the size of Greece. Nothing of Atlantis remained but the water-bloated bodies of children, of women and of men, floating on the cold morning waves, bodies at which the seagulls, grey and white, were already beginning to pick with their cruel beaks. And Islington woke. It was standing in the octagon of iron pillars, beside the great black door made of flint and tarnished silver. It touched the cold smoothness of the flint, the chill of the metal. It touched the table. It ran its finger lightly along the walls. Then it walked through the chambers of its hall, one after another, touching things, as if to reassure itself of their existence, to convince itself it was here and now. It followed patterns as it walked, smooth channels its bare feet had worn over the centuries in the rock. It stopped when it reached the rock pool, kneeling down and letting its fingers touch the cold water. There was a ripple in the water, which began with its fingertips and echoed out to the edges. The reflections in the pool, of the angel itself and the candle flames that framed it, shimmered and transformed. It was looking into a cellar. The angel concentrated for a moment. It could hear a telephone ring somewhere in the distance. Mr. Croup walked over to the telephone and picked up the handpiece. He looked rather pleased with himself.
Croup and Vandemar, he barked. Eyes gouged, noses twisted, tongues pierced, chins cleft, throats slit.
Mr. Croup, said the angel. They now have the key. I want the girl called Dor kept safe on her journey back to me.
Safe,
repeated Mr. Croup, unimpressed.
Right. We'll keep her safe. What a marvellous idea. Such originality. Positively astounding. Most people would be content with hiring assassins for executions, sly killings, vile murders even. Only you, sir, would hire the two finest cutthroats in the whole of space and time and then ask them to ensure a little girl remains unharmed.
See that she is, Mr. Croup. Nothing is to hurt her. Permit her to be harmed in any way, and you will displease me deeply. Do you understand?
Yes.
Croup shifted uncomfortably. Is there anything else? Asked Islington.
Yes, sir.
Croup coughed into his hand.
Do you remember the Marquis de Carabas?
Of course.
I take it that there is no such similar prohibition on extirpating the Marquis?
Not any longer, said the angel. Just protect the girl. It removed its hand from the water. The reflection was now merely candle flames and an angel of astonishing, perfectly androgynous beauty. The angel Islington stood up and returned to its inner chambers to await its eventual visitors.
"What did he say?"
asked Mr. Vandemar.
"He said, Mr. Vandemar, that we should feel free to do whatsoever we wished to the Marquis."
Vandemar nodded.
"Did that include killing him painfully?"
he asked, a little pedantically.
"Yes, Mr. Vandemar, I would say, on reflection, it did."
"That's good, Mr. Croup. Wouldn't like another telling off."
He looked up at the bloody thing hanging above them.
"Better get rid of the body, then."